Welcome to MoCo's Most Famous Podcast. Today we have a rare treat, a rare honor to speak with Isaiah Ike Leggett, a longtime Montgomery County executive. And Ike, so happy to see you and hear from you again. To what do we owe getting this honor today?
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to have an opportunity to talk to you. I think it's because I've gotten engaged in the referendum battle as it relates to single-member districts in Montgomery County and, of course, a new tax referendum proposed by Robert Ficker. And so I came out of retirement primarily because I think those two measures are counterproductive to good local governance. It will have a very, very difficult impact on the residents of the county if approved. And so I came out of retirement. I have grandkids that are in the school system. I continue to live in Montgomery County. This is a wonderful place in which to live, to work, to raise a family. And I could not simply sit by idly and see this kind of negative impact occur in our county.
I'm guessing that the easiest thing in the world would have been to stay retired, to stay quiet and sort of hidden. but you must feel very strongly about this to come out of retirement, obviously.
Certainly, because I had indicated to people that I had no desire to get involved in local politics, that I would look at things and evaluate them from my own personal perspective, but not to get engaged, not to be involved. And it's been rather difficult because people constantly call you, people see you on the street, and they want to know your opinion about X, Y, and Z. And I said, well, I'm retired. Go talk to someone else at this point in time. But I've held that promise up until this particular point involving these two initiatives that are on the ballot.
And the two initiatives that we're talking about are questions B and D. So let's take them one at a time. And if you can, as simply as you can explain them, explain kind of the pros and cons. Let's start with question B, which relates to property tax.
Well, I think it's important for people to go back and look historically at how we got to this point. Many years ago, I, along with Bruce Adams, Neil Potter, put together what is now basically the county's tax measure for terms of how the council would vote. There was a measure initially proposed was similar to Proposition 13 that came out of California. It was quite draconian. And so what we did as an alternative to that was to come up with a plan that suggested at that time that taxes could increase up to the level of inflation, but to go above that, you needed seven council members to override that. And we had that in place for a number of years. That was later changed by Mr. Ficker, an initiative to require all nine members approve initiative above the rate of inflation. He's now come forward to add something even more draconian to this. Not only you must have all nine members approve it to go above inflation, but you can no longer go above inflation. So it's a hard, inflexible cap. And the impacts of that could be quite severe. Say, for example, if you had a situation where you stayed below level inflation for 5 to 10 years, and in 1 year you had a crisis such as what we have today with the pandemic, you had 1 year where you needed monies for education, for healthcare, for transportation, the county is looking at a huge potential deficit coming up. And at 1 year, you needed to go above that in order to save the county from more disastrous problems long term. You could not do that. You could not go one dime above inflation. And no one believes that you will not have the need for additional resources in some time in the foreseeable future. So this would be disastrous. The impact of that would be that all the programs, exclusive of education to some degree, but even part of education, you could not go beyond the maintenance of effort level. That will draw monies from everything else. And so for transportation, environment, healthcare, recreation, libraries, they will be decimated in the budget for the future. And to me, it could also jeopardize our AAA bond rating, which means that we would have to borrow money at a much higher cost. The impact of this could be disastrous for the county long term. And so I just could not sit by and watch that happen without getting up to say, well, we need to make certain that people fully understand what is happening. And so for me, former Congressman Connor Morella, David Blair, and for Carmen Larson, we decided to form a group to go out and oppose both B and D. So we're asking people to vote no on B and D.
All right, so let's talk about D, and this relates to council members and the numbers and at large. So if you could explain that so people can understand that, please.
Well, a little bit of history about that as well. When I was elected to the county council back in 1985-86, the council was only 7 people at that time. And we were well around about 650,000 residents at that point, 600,000 or so. But all the council members, although 5 were actually required to live in a certain district, the entire county had an opportunity to vote for all of the councilmen. And I was one of the 2 at-large members. And so we later decided to add 2 additional council members and came up with the current system, which is 5 district council members and 4 at-large. There have been some attempts or discussions in the past whether or not we should increase it. But never have we seriously considered an idea that would make all of the council members in single member districts. So that you have no at-large members. So people have proposed that. And I think the reason for proposing that, I think a little short of what I think we need for good governance. One reason for that is that there's an argument that you get greater representation by district members. Well, if you look at it, currently you elect 5 people. You have a chance to vote for 5 members. Mm-hmm. But if you approve this measure, you go down to 1. Mm-hmm. The issues that impact any particular jurisdiction or district are matters that are countywide. How do you determine if a stream is bad that you only look at it in your particular district when it may be countywide for environmental purposes? How do you look at education in an isolated vacuum? You can't do that. Crime. All of those things need a countywide perspective. And so you end up with a system that is more parochial. You end up with a system where you have fewer people to vote for. And I don't think that it provides very good governance from that. Most jurisdictions around the country have gone away from single member districts because of that reason. Just our neighbors, Prince George's County, for example, had single member districts for a long period of time. They've just added 2 at-large members. Now, there's a proposal to go to 11 members and simply add 2 additional districts. Well, that may be preferable to what we're looking at now in the ballot of 9 members in a single district. To me, that's just simply counterproductive. Another argument that has been made has been that a good portion of the people who are elected to council come from the greater Silver Spring area. Well, that may be true today, but that has not been true historically. Mm-hmm. For example, I was elected as a council member 4 times. At large. I live in Burgessville. I'm probably 15 miles from Silver Spring. And basically where I live, you look around, there are very few houses here. You see more horses and cows in my neighborhood than you see people. And so I was elected 4 times. Former Councilmember Gail Ewan lived in Potomac. She was elected at large. Michael Subin lived in Gaithersburg. Nancy Florine lived in I think it's Kensington. But you may have a quirk every once in a while, and there may be some issues or challenges that may develop, but that is not the long-lasting impact of it. Some have suggested that it will be different as it relates to gender. We only have 1 female on the council. Well, historically, that has not been the case. I served with 4 females, and it's been at least 4 for many of the years of the last 20, 25 years. So what you may have in one term what I call a quirk where a few members are elected from a particular area, or you end up with more males than females. But if you look at it historically, that is not the case. So we're suggesting here by this amendment that we throw all of that out because we have a quirk in 1 4-year term that I think will have more disasters and negative impacts.
From what you're hearing from people and maybe from polling, do you feel like you'll be successful with your fight against question B and question D?
Well, the people that we've had an opportunity to engage and they know the history of this and understand what's at stake, I think there's a pretty powerful message. But here's the challenge that you have here. Well, we got involved in this very late. This is just something we started just a week or so ago. Mm-hmm. This is a presidential election year. In a presidential election year, you get a large turnout people, an unusually high turnout this particular year. And many of these people vote only once every 4 years. They're not as engaged as you may think that they are. They're coming out to vote for president. And so you could have one or two things that will happen. They may not even look at and address the referendum issues. If you look at the ballot in terms of the number of votes, probably 99+9% of everybody who comes out to vote are going to vote for the presidential candidate that they prefer. And probably only about 90-95% of them will vote for Congress. Maybe about 80% of them would vote for the school board members. And you go down from that to the judges. By the time you get to the ballot initiative, you're probably talking only about 55% of the voters. So it's a much smaller number of people that vote for that. And so you have people that come out who are not as engaged. People do not read all the information. And so they may not hear or know about the things that we're talking about. And you could have unintended consequences as a result of that. So those are the kinds of things that worry me, that we've gotten engaged rather late. But the people that I've talked to or people that have communicated with us in some fashion, we've had a very good positive response from.
Do you get the sense with all that has gone on in our country in the last 4 years that people will come out to vote? I think they know it's important, but will they actually come out and vote in record numbers, do you feel?
I think so. We may have some questions about the mechanics of this. And looking at what has happened in the early votes thus far, states that have voted already, it looks pretty strong thus far. The only thing that I think could change that would be if there's a fear because of either things such as the weather or if the pandemic turns far worse in the next couple of weeks. So those voters who wanted to vote in person may change their minds, and you can get a last minute change as a result of that. Presuming that we don't have any of those factors, I think you're looking at a record turnout this year.
What is your message to people who are on the fence and say, my vote doesn't matter?
Well, it does matter. And if you look at some of the things that have passed or some of the things that have failed, many of them have been by very small margins. I have a friend in Howard County, for example, right north of here, where I'm sitting. She won her election by 6 votes, not 60, not 600, not 6,000, 6. And you've seen in Virginia, for example, a couple of years ago, there was actually a tie, and they broke the tie by a coin flip.
Wow.
And so every vote counts. And when you look at things such as the initiatives, when it has such a profound impact on the quality of life, I think it is too important to just sit on the sideline. It was too important for me, despite what I've said earlier about not getting engaged in local politics, for me to come out of retirement and to get engaged in this matter because it's so important.
I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the presidential race. We've seen things in the last 3.5 years that we've never seen before because they've never happened. How does that make you feel personally, seeing some of the things that have happened and continue to happen coming from the White House?
Well, I was one of the people who thought, although I had some trepidations about Donald Trump being elected president, I thought once in the office, once understanding what's at stake and the need to represent and to be the president of all people of the country, that in some way the power, the aura of the office would ultimately reform him in a way that would be much more of a statesperson, much more of a leader for everyone. And unfortunately, to my chagrin, that has not happened. And the thing that I think worries me most is that there's not been an attempt to really try to bring people together. The American people are very good in many ways, but we lack the leadership in the national level that is purposely intended or trying to bring people together. And so when you look across the spectrum of issues, challenges that we face, I am immensely disappointed about where we stand today. I think we are far more divided than we've ever been. We have a pandemic that has not been handled very well. We have an economy that's on rocky sleds at this point in time, and our international affairs are really in disorder and have not responded to the challenges around the world. All of those things and the components underneath all of those have me particularly worried. And now you get news that because of the way the votes are possibly being tallied, that the president indicated that there may not be a peaceful transfer of power. I mean, that's unheard of. Hopefully, that's just rhetoric. And hopefully, once we have an election, and if he loses, that there will be a peaceful transfer. But what I've heard and what I've seen, given what has happened in our country the last 3.5 years, really has me worried. This is something that you see in a small country where you have dictators. And America is much better than that. And I'm hopeful that we'll come together, we'll find a solution for the virus, that we'll get our economy back together, and that we'll still be the leaders of the free world and a shining example for many around the globe.
So I'm sure when people run into you, they're looking for a hopeful message. What do you say to people? How it's very difficult to be optimistic right now. How do you, is your message optimistic? Is it hopeful? What would you tell people who look to someone like you, who was a very successful leader at the local level? How can you have hope at this point?
Well, I've always been a very hopeful person. I do not engage in petty politics. It is not for me to question or challenge people in a personal manner. And I try to look at the bright side. I think that there are more things which we agree about than we disagree. I think that there are more things which we can work on that can find a better solution for our country than those things we disagree about. There are going to be challenges. We're facing challenges of racism today. We're facing challenges of how we deal with some aspects of bigotry as it relates to religion and many other things around our nation. But when you think about where we stand today, I've literally traveled now all over the world. There are very few places, if any, that can match what we have here in the United States of America. It is worth saving. It is worth fighting for. And if we're not prepared to look optimistically toward the future, we could end that. I am very, very hopeful that the democracy that we have, that the people that are in this country and the people who have led us and are potentially in line to lead us can get us back on the right track. So I'm not downcast in the sense that I feel hopeless. I feel that we can resolve the challenges and that we will resolve. Too much is at stake, and that we've worked too hard to get to this point. You know, we've overcome several wars. I served in Vietnam. We've had many foreign adventures that have gone wrong. We had the civil rights struggle. We suffered through slavery, a civil war. We've done all of those things. Yet and still, we've managed to come out of that the strongest, the best country in the world. And I do not believe that one person, 1 4-year term, is capable of, in any way, shape, or form, of distracting us from our mission.
You mentioned race. In some ways, we've come a long way, and in some way, it seems like we haven't come a long way, seeing all the things.
No, we have come a long way, and I've come a long way personally. When people say to me, boy, I haven't seen enough change to change, that may be to the point that we have not gotten to the hopeful change that we all want, but there have been a great deal of change in America, a great deal of change that I think for the good in America. And there are personal stories. My life story and where I've based from is an American story that could, in my opinion, only have happened in America. So there's been change. You may argue there have not been enough change in certain sectors, but there's enough change here that should give us enough hope that we can continue to fight for it and feel optimistic about the future.
A couple of days ago, we heard the decision by the Kentucky Attorney General. There's one charge of reckless endangerment, but no homicide charges for any of the three officers. What was your reaction when you heard the news?
I was disappointed, and my first reaction was, I would like to see the evidence that the Attorney General presented to the grand jury. Because I think therein lies the challenge for us in terms of understanding why they did not come out with an indictment of some sort. We don't have that evidence. And so, and unfortunately, it precludes us from having a full evaluation of what the grand jury saw, because it is much more limited in terms of transparency that you would see in an open court. So you could have a chance to better evaluate that. And so until and unless I see the evidence that was presented, whether or not it was cherry-picked, whether or not it was comprehensive, what happened as it relates to the grand jury process would be something that I would have to evaluate. But overall, I think I was very disappointed. And I think the real solution for many of us would be, let's see the evidence that was presented, because the evidence that I've seen probably could have at least had an indictment or a trial. And whether or not there could have been a conviction or not, I'm not sure. But at least enough to charge and have a trial. But maybe there's something that we missed, and maybe there's some evidence we don't know about. But my view would be, let the public see the evidence and make an appropriate informed decision on that basis.
How do you think we're doing on the subject of race in Montgomery County? Everybody knows that 1.1 million people in Montgomery County, it is known and it is a very diverse county. There have been some issues, just like there are everywhere else in the country, involving police. There was a racist social media post with Dr. Travis Gales, Will Jawando, council member. So you see things that make you just shudder, but it seems like this happens all across the country. It's not unique to Montgomery County, but what is your feeling on how we are on race in Montgomery County today?
Well, believe it or not, Montgomery County is a better example for race tolerance than anywhere around the country. So if you say we have problems in Montgomery County and we have not achieved the goals and objectives that we want, then you know how bad it is in other segments of the community. Mm-hmm. Now, having said that, we have some real challenges in Montgomery County, and I was not immune from that. Now, take in mind when I first ran for public office in 1985-86, the African-American population in Montgomery County was about 5 or 6%. And I was somewhat hesitant about running. And I thought that was not a sufficient basis for me to run with such a small African-American population. I once told a person trying to argue with me to run for the office, I said, if I had that number, 5 or 6%, and I quadrupled that number and had the former mayor of Chicago, Richard Daley, counting the votes for me, there's no way I was going to win that election. So I was very reluctant to run. In fact, when I first ran, there was no photograph of Ike Leggett on the campaign brochure. None. Because we were so fearful that people would not sufficiently read it, even go beyond just the outside of it to understand my credentials, qualifications, what have you. So I ran for 6 months without a picture of Ike Leggett run for public office. I recall, this was after I'd won the primary, and we were in, we were at Friendship Heights. Right on Eastern Avenue, Friendship Heights. And I was passing out literature, and an elderly white gentleman walked out of one of the high-rise buildings from Friendship Heights there, and I gave him my literature. He looked at it, looked at me, looked at the literature again, looked at me. You know what he said?
What?
He said, young man, I do not live in the District of Columbia. So what he thought was that I was on the wrong side of Western Avenue. And I was running for an office in the district because he just could not imagine that there was an African-American running for county council at large. But I haven't said all of that and all the challenges and difficulties that I've had, and there have been all kinds of racial challenges and top problems associated with my being in public office. You never heard a great deal about them because I didn't talk too much publicly about them. But there have been a number that were directed at me, and what we see now is just the tip of the iceberg that happened to me. So take in mind, I go back from 1985 all the way up to the present. And if you conclude that the present is much worse, you have a pretty good picture of what I suffered through all those years. And I've been in public life, in public service in Montgomery County for probably 32 years, serving at the head of the County Human Rights Commission, 4 terms as county executive, and 12 years as county executive, 4 terms as a council member. And believe it or not, with a very small African-American population throughout all of that, I never had a close race. I won all of my races overwhelmingly. So what that says is there are a large number of people in Montgomery County that are good people, people that respect folks, people who are willing to give you an opportunity, people that will go out and vote for folks. But there's also a segment, and a segment of the population that's not that way. And I don't want to see the county or even our police force denigrated because of the challenges related to some, which are a smaller number, but the good that the majority are doing. For people to vote for me and turn over in my hands a budget of people of one plus million people, a budget of $5+ billion, and to do that three times. They don't do that accidentally. They did that because they knew what they were doing and had no problem the hesitation of doing that. Yeah. That's why I'm optimistic. But I'm not going to sit here and say to you that there are no challenges and no difficulties and problems that we have to work on.
Okay. I'm not going to ask you how your successor, Mark Eldridge, is doing, because that would not be fair. But I want to ask you, what do you think what do you think is his biggest single challenge right now and moving forward?
Well, the challenge is that the economy continues to change, and we now are faced with a pandemic that impacts us on a variety of fronts. One, the overriding health challenges that we have in terms of how people live their lives. We have people who are indoors, people who want to get out, people want to engage more. We have health concerns, and that therefore impacts us economically, because especially in minority communities, they are disproportionately hit as it relates to this pandemic. And thirdly, on top of that, you have the racial issues that have percolated over the county for a number of years. So you have an economic challenge, you have a health challenge, and the county and the nation is far more divided. And much of that is happening right in the glare of the cameras. You see, many years ago, we did not have everybody walking around with an iPhone in their back pocket could film a lot of this and see this on screen day in and day out. And so you have to govern in that atmosphere. And that's a real tough challenge for anyone to do so. And when you have the challenges of financial strain, then it impacts everything else from education, transportation, providing services and support for people throughout the community. So it's a variety of things that's in an unprecedented manner for which it would challenge almost anybody.
You mentioned COVID-19. Have you or your family been touched, if I may ask, by COVID-19?
Members of my extended family have been. And I've had some people who've been very sick and few that have died, but not in the immediate family, my wife or kids or those kinds of things. But a number of people in the extended family, yes.
What is your message to people who think this thing is over? I'm not even going to talk about the hoax people, but what about people who think we're rounding the corner and this thing is over?
Well, we may be around the corner, but around that corner, coming out of the tunnel, we're faced with an oncoming train or a four-wheeler that's coming dead at us. This is by no means over. And oftentimes, people make those assessments not because they don't necessarily follow the logic medically, but they have a political agenda and trying to, in fact, in some way or shape, a political agenda that fits that narrative. It's best to feel that way, to believe that way, because politically that's advantageous to do so. But medically, and I say to people, you need to listen to the medical professional. You need to understand what they are saying, because if it's not you today, it may be someone in your family tomorrow. And when you have the numbers of people that have been affected, even if you discount all the number that have died, well over 200,000 today, even those who are impacted in some way who not face death, there are large numbers of people who are severely ill and have long-term impacts as a result of this disease. This is nothing to play with. And so you need to listen to the medical professionals.
I wanted to ask you about a couple of leaders who left us in the last few months. One more recently, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I don't know if you knew her. What kind of legacy do you feel she left America?
I met her, but I really don't know her that well personally. And as you know, I served for 30-some years as a law professor and assistant associate dean of Howard University Law School. And so I followed her career quite carefully. And I would say that we've lost a giant, a person who clearly understood the law, but lived by an example of courage, determination, insight, wit. And I think we have lost in many ways a true, true hero, a heroine that I think has served this nation well. It's an example, especially to women, to have someone with that courage, that determination, and also that level of success. I'm hopeful that in the future, the court will, even though there may have been some of the opinions that happen to be in the dissent, that they will look very carefully at what she said, because the guidelines, what she said and how she said them, how well she wrote, could be insightful to us going forward in the future. This is a tremendous loss, not just for those who may believe there should be a more liberal court, but any person who looks at the rule of law and understand the role that a justice plays in our lives, you cannot find a better example.
Another giant that we sadly lost, John Lewis, known for Good Trouble. I don't know if you knew him, but...
Oh, yeah.
what are your memories, and what was his legacy, greatest legacy, do you think that he left?
Well, believe it or not, I go back a long, long ways with John Lewis, because I was very much involved in the 60s as part of the student protest movement. I served as a student government president at Southern University in my senior year. And so I had an opportunity to meet many of the people engaged in the civil rights struggle, from Andy Young, Dr. King, John Lewis, and a whole bunch of others, a contemporary during that period of time. Because my early life started off as a student activist back in the 60s, and I got an opportunity to meet him. In fact, one of the things that I'm so regretful for, because at one point in time, and people don't realize it, in the greatness of John Lewis, he was actually pushed aside from the organization that he started, the Student Nonviolent Commission. And I sided, although I was not a voting member at the time, I sided with the people who were much more aggressive. At that time, Stokely Carmichael, H. Rapp Brown, and some of the others, who wanted a much more engaged level of activity by students. And I sided at that point in time with that movement. Lewis, who lost that battle, never gave up the principle that he had of nonviolence, and we could do this in a more constructive way. And once pushed aside, didn't go off in a corner and lament and, you know, walk away from it, but continued to be focused on the things that he believed. So he rose in sort of a non-leadership position after he was cast aside. And that, to me, is the greatness of him. Despite the fact that he was pushed aside, despite the fact that he was early ignored, he never went away. And he continued to maintain focus on the points that he made, which said we could do this through nonviolence. We can do this in a way that confronts the bigger picture that we're facing without going through some of the challenges that people wanted to be confronted with. And I regret that now, looking back and said how foolish I was, but a lot of those were foolish at the time. But he did the right thing, and he continued to do that and never wavered from that, despite the fact that he was constantly being thrown in jail many times, removed from leadership position. He never lost focus. And that's the mark of an excellent leader.
In your retirement, how often do you spend any time thinking back on your incredible life? You know, I'm sure you're busy enjoying retirement and staying away from politics until this recent thing. But, I mean, looking back at, you know, born in a small town in Texas, grew up in a small town in Louisiana, 12 siblings in a small house, and just the amazing things that you've experienced. Do you spend time thinking about that, or it's only when people...
I have more so... And I think my wife and others have convinced me I probably need to sit down and finish something that I thought about that is a book to sort of reflect my life. And I had a good indication of that most recently before the pandemic, right before the pandemic. My granddaughter asked me to come to her school during Black History Month. Mm-hmm. And I came and I brought some photographs and some other things. And a lot of what we take for granted, things that I have done, things that I experienced, become somewhat subtle in your mind. But an opportunity to sit there and talk to these fifth graders and to explain to them what happened. And when you say to them, I had to sit at the back of the bus. I had to sit in the balcony. I could not drink at the fountain that I wanted to drink in. I picked cotton, I did this. And you look at them and their eyes were just amazed with, oh, I'm not just talking about something I read in a textbook. I'm talking about talking to someone who has experienced these things. And when I told them I met Dr. King and I did this, that, and other, it was one of the most remarkable and amazing experiences I've had in a long time. Because far too often, we hold those things into ourselves, or we talk to contemporaries who understand those things fairly well. But if you get the chance to see that through the eyes of a young kid, who've not had those experiences, and they are now seeing someone firsthand in the flesh who's talking about not what I read, not about what I heard about, but what I experienced. And that was such a remarkable, remarkable experience that I had. And I think that has pursued, that has forced me to pursue the opportunity to go back and put it in writing.
And what you're talking about reminds me of my mother, who's still around. She's 87. She's a Holocaust survivor, and she's worked at the Holocaust Museum for 20 years. And it's the same thing. People come up to her. It's like, wait, you actually went through this? It's not just numbers in a book or facts or film or anything like that.
Yeah.
People that actually, it's so much more meaningful to kids. So that's really amazing that you do that. And if you do write a book, I'm sure many people will buy it, because you have an incredible story, if I may say. Your wife is such a powerhouse. How is Catherine doing? And does she miss the life of being first lady?
No, you know, she's quite busy. She has, people didn't realize it, but during the whole time that she served as our first lady, she had a full-time job down in Washington, D.C. and worked, you know, almost 24/7 sometimes, I think. And she's adapted very well, because she continued to work on things of her interest, especially in the arts and nonprofit community. And she is just as delighted to do that from non-first lady role as opposed to the time she was the first lady. And she's quite busy in her regular job. Mm-hmm. And so she has adapted fairly well to all of the Zooms and all of the challenges we face in terms of work relationships today, much better than I have. So she is quite content with what she's doing.
And if also, if I may say, you know, they talk about when presidents finish their first term or their second term, if they get to two terms, how they age, and, you know, you see the picture side by side. You look exactly the same as you did. So what do you count? How do you account for that?
Well, it's all internal. Well, first of all, I have an opportunity now to get out, to exercise, to eat much more healthily than I've done in the past. And so it has served me well. But there are days and challenges when you get up and you have those aches and pains, and you may not see them, but I feel them.
Another question about retirement. For people that don't understand, you know, holding public office for so many years and the hard work, and it's basically 24/7, just how nice it must be to, you know, putting aside for a second questions B&B, it must be nice to just rest and just kind of sit down on a couch and not have to worry about every single thing that's going on.
Let me tell you a story. When I was county executive, I would not travel outside of the country, very far from Montgomery County, during the months from November to almost the end of February or March. Why? Because I was fearful it's going to snow. And I did not want to be away in the Bahamas on the beach somewhere, you know, drinking a little drink with a cocktail in it somewhere, and looking back and saying, oh boy, I should have been in Montgomery County. And so I was worried about those things constantly, about what was happening in the county. And I could never go somewhere and just totally relax. Yeah. Now all of that is gone. Right before, well, last year we went to Australia, New Zealand for 3.5 weeks. We've been to Africa for a safari. We've done some other things as well. And I don't have to worry about looking at the cell phone every few minutes or worried about what happened. In fact, you know, it feels quite relaxing to do so. But, you know, it took a while to adjust to that after the first month or two, but after that, everything was fine.
Gary Williams, the great former coach at Maryland, who I'm sure you know, described retirement to me this way. He said that when the phone rings now, he doesn't care. It's like, okay, it's the phone ringing. But before, it's like, oh, what did one of my student athletes do? And every time, especially if it was after 10 p.m., that was never a good thing. And that was his definition of retirement. So it sounds like
it certainly did. In fact, if I got a call late at night after 10, 11 o'clock at night, and I saw Chief Manger's number popped up, a Tim Feinstein neighbor popped up, my eyes started rolling, my palms started to sweat, because I said, oh, this could not be a good call.
Okay, so last message for people about questions B&D and about voting in general. What do you want to tell people?
First of all, I hope that you would read carefully all the material that's been sent to you. Understand that I, as your former county executive, someone who served in Montgomery County for 28 years in public life, will not come to you and ask you to vote against these measures unless it was very important. Please read carefully, make up your own mind, but also consider the things that I've said about it, that B and D are both bad for Montgomery County, and you should reject them. This is a wonderful place to live, to work, to raise a family. Let's keep it that way.
Ike, I want to thank you first for your service for so many years. Secondly, for spending time with us today. It's been a rare pleasure and an honor. I could speak to you for hours, but I think you probably have better things to do. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.